antigenic drift, where the virus gradually evolves to escape the immune system. Adding, for influenza and other coronaviruses we know quite well, it takes about 10 years for the virus to accumulate enough changes not to be recognized by antibodies in the blood. But the alternative is the sudden appearance of a completely new strain with game-changing transmissibility, virulence, or immune evasive properties. Ravi Gupta, professor of clinical microbiology at the University of Cambridge, refers to these strains as super variants and says he is 80% sure that another one will emerge. The question is when. Ravi Gupta says, "We've got a Delta pandemic at the moment," adding, "This new Delta Plus variant is relatively wimpy compared to the kind of thing I'm talking about. It has two mutations from the Delta strain. I don't think they are that worrisome, and it hasn't taken off in a big way in other countries. But it's inevitable that there will be another significant variant in the next 2 years, and it will compete with Delta, and it may outcompete Delta." There are a number of ways in which this might arise. During the latter half of 2020, epidemiologists began to observe signs of a concerning phenomena known as viral recombination, in which different versions of SARS-CoV-2 exchange mutations and combined to form a totally new strain. Thankfully, Ravi Gupta says, recombination does not appear to be that common, but it remains one feasible source of a new super variant, particularly in parts of the world where sizable proportions of the population remain unvaccinated and viral strains can circulate freely. He says, "Now that Delta is overwhelmingly the key virus, this has become less likely. But there are large swathes of the planet that we're not sampling and we don't know what's going on, so it is a very real possibility." The second is a series of major mutations, either resulting in a greatly enhanced version of Delta or something very different. It is thought there remains significant scope for this to happen. Gideon Schreiber, professor of biomolecular sciences, says, "While recent variants are variations of the Delta, the virus has huge potential to evolve in the future. More complex mutations can evolve, with simultaneous mutations at more than one position, which may be more problematic." In recent weeks, concerns have emerged that the use of new antiviral pills, in particular Merck's molnupiravir, could contribute to this by actively encouraging SARS-CoV-2 to evolve. Molnupiravir works by interfering with the virus's ability to replicate, littering its genome with mutations until it can no longer reproduce. Some virologists have argued that if any of these viral mutants survive and spread to others, it could theoretically spur the rise of new variants. Others acknowledge that while this is worth monitoring, it is not enough of a concern to deny severely ill patients a potentially life-saving drug. Ravi Gupta says that a greater problem, and one more likely to lead to a super variant, is the persistently high infection rate in countries such as the United Kingdom, due to the ability of the Delta variant to transmit between vaccinated individuals. He says, "The more infections there are per day, the more chance that there is someone out there, a patient X, who gets infected and their T cells are not strong enough to clear the infection because they're immune suppressed." He adds, "So they end up having the infection over a number of days. They've got some antibodies knocking around because they've had a partial vaccine response and the virus learns to evade them, and then that spills out." Earlier this year, Ravi Gupta published a paper that showed that this process could occur in severely ill patients who had been administered convalescent plasma laden with virus-killing antibodies. because their immune system still couldn't clear the virus, it learned to mutate around these antibodies. It has been speculated that the widespread use of convalescent plasma early in the pandemic was responsible for driving the emergence of the variants. He says, "We don't know for sure, but a lot of plasma was used, and it was potentially one of the drivers for the variants. It was used very widely in Brazil, India, the United Kingdom, and the United States, all of whom developed their own sets of variants." Epidemiologists are now trying to model what a new super variant might look like. So far, the major transformations in the virus have helped to increase its transmissibility. William Hanage explains that one of the reasons why the Delta variant had such an impact is because it grows extremely rapidly within human cells before the immune system kicks into gear. As a result, people infected with the Delta variant carry approximately 1,200 times more viral particles in their noses compared with the original SARS-CoV-2 strain and develop symptoms 2 to 3 days sooner. This is a result of natural selection. Different copies of the virus are being created all the time, but the ones that have survived and become more dominant are the ones that are more capable of infecting new people. However, in countries such as the United Kingdom, where the unvaccinated portion of the population is diminishing, this could start to change. Strains that can sidestep antibodies are likely to become more dominant, making the next super variant far more likely to be able to evade at least some parts of the immune response. William Hanage says the strains of the virus that end up surviving and becoming dominant vary, depending on which stage of the pandemic you're in. He adds, "So far, it's been much more important for the virus to be transmitting effectively into the remaining pool of unprotected people, but that is expected to change around about now." While this might sound a little terrifying, it's not all bad news. Because the COVID-19 vaccines are designed with viral evolution in mind, epidemiologists do not expect any new super variant to render them completely useless, and so it will be extremely unlikely to lead to large serious outbreaks, such as those of the past 2 years. In addition, there is a second generation of COVID-19 vaccines that have been developed. Vaccine developer Novavax is hoping to obtain regulatory approval for its jabs in the next couple of months, while many more vaccines are expected to come on the market between now and 2023. These platforms are all taking their own steps to combat potential future variants. Child poverty in Britain. Part 1.
Poverty is a lot more widespread in the UK than perhaps people would think. There's a lot of what we would call hidden poverty, people who perhaps are living in normal middle-class areas, perhaps, or normal housing in villages and out in the rural areas, who you would never guess it to look at it from the outside, but who actually are suffering quite acute poverty, trying to make ends meet on a very fixed income with rising costs, rising transport costs, and all kinds of other things that they're just finding very, very difficult to come to terms with in today's environment. Well, the standard measure of poverty in the UK is 60% of the average salary across the UK. However, there's an awful lot of people who are surviving in work on quite a modest income, and yet who are finding times very difficult. A lot of people on fixed income, pensioners for instance, are finding it very difficult to meet increasing costs, whether that's heating, whether it's food, whether it's transport, on an income that simply isn't keeping up with inflation and rising costs.
Well, we know that there remains very high levels of child poverty within the UK. Currently, there are 2.5 million children growing up below the breadline. There are far too many children across the country whose parents can't afford to pay the basic bills, such as keeping the home warm during winter, being able to buy enough food for their children, being able to clothe them. The UK has one of the highest rates of child poverty within Europe. We need to see the government place much more of a priority on meeting the promise that it has made. Both parties within the current coalition government in the UK have committed to ending child poverty by 2020. We have seen a recent report that is showing that far from actually being able to meet that promise, we're likely to see child poverty rise massively in the years to come.
So in the UK, we tend to look at a relative definition of poverty, where somebody's poor if they have less than 60% of the income that the person in the middle of the income distribution has, the so-called median person. But we also look at a definition of absolute poverty, where a poverty line is set at a point in time as an absolute standard of living. And then that's kept constant over time, despite what happens to the incomes of other people in the UK. Now, this is set at a relatively high line. It's certainly not anything that's comparable to absolute poverty, as you might think of it, in a developing country. But it does help to keep track of what's happening to the incomes of those who are relatively poor in the UK. We published a report looking at what's likely to happen to relative and absolute poverty in the UK over the next 10 years. We found that for both children and working age people, that poverty rates are due to increase over the next 10 years, despite the government's introduction of policies like universal credit, which are designed to reduce poverty.
The report from the Institute for Fiscal Studies was really quite alarming. It says there's going to be quite shocking rises in child poverty if the current policies of the government continue without any change. Now, this is a warning. It's not inevitable that this will happen, and this is why we need to see renewed action from the government. We really need them to look again at their child poverty strategy that they published earlier this year, because I think the report shows the strategy is insufficient. The situation at the moment is very difficult for the poorest families and the children in those families. We already have quite high levels of child poverty relative to the rest of Europe, but what we are now seeing with the difficult economic circumstances that we have is stagnating wages. We're seeing prices going up very quickly, particularly for basics like food and fuel. And we're also still seeing job losses, which is hitting some families.
Back financially for our family it's been a real struggle. I'm probably taking nearly half less than my wages, you know, at the moment, and it's a real struggle, a really struggle at the moment.
It's a bit cramped up there with four kids in one bedroom and a baby in the other, so it's a bit difficult sometimes, I know. Right, let's take these in, and then I'll come back to the other one. she's just been telling me, saving up for an Iron Man hand. You know, she's always been out and about doing lots of things. So no one was more shocked than myself when she became very ill just after Christmas. In fact, she actually had what we thought was flu around Boxing Day last year. And then by the beginning of January, she was very, very ill. And I now think that was probably the start of what became viral meningitis. My daughter struggles along. Her and her husband struggles along. He had to take unpaid leave because she was really unwell and was going for medical appointments. And I was coming here to look after the children while she was going to appointments and so on. And then she had a fall and was taken into hospital. And he had to have time off. Well, he's not in a job. He's in retail. And he's not in a job where you get carer's leave and you're not particularly protected.
Even going to see June in the hospital, you know, I didn't have the money for petrol, I didn't have the money for car park, you know, so it's, you know, it was a real struggle. I've had to phone her up and say, look, I can't come tonight because I can't afford to get there. So it is hard, struggle.
Well, I had viral meningitis in January this year and was rushing to hospital. I finally got over that in March. Then I become very ill in May. I started deteriorating and I've just got worse and worse. I've been to the hospital and everything. They're doing loads of tests on me because they don't exactly know what is actually wrong with me. And my husband had to have his hours cut so that he can help with me being ill. So my husband's lost 9 hours worth of wages, basically. They've cut his hours by 9 hours. I've applied for DLA, which I was informed to apply for. I've only just recently received a letter saying that I'm not entitled to DLA, that I can do certain things that I can't actually do. And it's affected us quite a lot because we're actually on key meters on the gas and the electric, and we're putting in more money because obviously I've got to keep warm as well because I sit here freezing. We're putting in more money on the gas, more money on the electric, everything's going up. And it's just, it's very, very hard.
Poverty in Britain is relative in the sense that all of my life I've known the principles of having a national health service which gives free health care at the point of use to everybody, and a principle of a welfare state which is meant to protect everyone against the worst aspects of poverty. It started, it was called National Assistance, it then became Social Security, and it's now a series of benefits that are meant to prevent people living in total poverty. It works to the extent that there is very little absolute starvation and absolute poverty in Britain, but it doesn't mean there aren't a lot of people leading very poor lives or a lot of people living in very bad conditions. There are also a series of benefit traps that are brought about by a combination of expensive private rented housing, inadequate jobs, and a very tough regime in gaining access to benefits.
My daughter, who's a genuine case, who is absolutely struggling day to day to live, and her husband as well, and yes, have we claimed? Yes. We came for DLA and sort of incapacity, disability and carers support or whatever it is. And we've just received this letter. I'm absolutely gobsmacked. This letter's just come yesterday or the day before to say that my daughter is not entitled to anything. She's not entitled to any care. She's not entitled to anything because of her lack of mobility. I honestly think they've been reading the wrong forms. Her husband is cooking all the meals, he's shopping, he's looking after the children. I'm coming and doing what I can, her 14-year-old daughter's having to do stuff. You know, it is beyond belief.
It's really hard, and the thing is, I can't physically get up and go and do shopping and things like that now, so I have to rely on my husband to go and do the shopping, so I have to sit there and try and work out a list that isn't going to be too much. You know, and we've got to cut back on certain things. I used to get great big bowls of fruit and things like that. Now, I used to get like 2 packs of the oranges and things like that because my kids love fruit. Now I've cut it right back to 1 of each instead. So they've got fruit to go in their lunch boxes and that. And then I have to say to them during the week, well, no, you have to wait till like mummy goes shopping. You know, you can't touch those because at the end of the day, it's for your packed lunch. But it's affected us quite a lot in that sense.
So what we have in this area is unemployment roughly at the national average, child poverty levels well above the national average, and housing conditions well below the national average. And so we have a lot of people on the waiting list to try and get rented accommodation from the council or local authority, which has does its best, but it has a shortage. So most of those people are forced to live in private rented accommodation, which can be very expensive. Recently, a report came out from Shelter, which is a housing charity and campaigning organisation, which said that nobody should pay more than a third of their take-home pay, their income, on rent. There are people around here who pay two-thirds of their income, 70% sometimes, on rent. It's that expensive, and so the poverty comes about from the costs. The government is proposing to cap benefits at a total figure per week, including housing costs. The previous government separated housing costs from benefits, and that will mean destitution for many people in my community. So the poverty is real, the poverty is serious, and I see it.
Housing has a huge part to play in relation to child poverty, and we have very much focused on the impacts on health, on educational attainment, and on child welfare that living in bad housing can have. And we very much know that actually, if children aren't given the opportunity to be able to get a good education and the qualifications that they need in order to be able to lift themselves out of poverty, they tend, because of their housing situation, it may prevent them, if they're living in overcrowded conditions, from being able to do their homework or to attend school on a regular basis. What we tend to see is that these children remain in poverty in later life and find it much harder to be able to lift themselves out of it.
Well, I think it's an important moment in Britain at the moment. Obviously, the crisis began in 2008. It shows absolutely no signs of being over yet, and that means there's going to be probably a once-in-a-generation attempt to lower the living standards of working people, to cut their welfare, to cut their wages, to dispense with their jobs, and to make them pay for a crisis which was created in the banking industry for which they had absolutely no responsibility. And it seems to me that that's an essential moment when people in the trade union movement, in campaigning movements, people who want to see a more equal and just society, have to step forward and try and do something about the fact that the very richest people in the society are trying to make some of the poorest people in the society pay for a crisis that they didn't create. Welfare, by definition, and especially after 20 years where welfare provision has been cut back rather than expanded, welfare provision, by definition, is for the most needy, the poorest, the most desperate sections of the population. And after 20 years of cuts, there's not a lot of fat on the bone, despite what the millionaires and the current government tell us. So what this is going to do is it's going to hit the very poorest, the very neediest, hardest. People who are long-term sick or disabled are going to be hit more than the average. Women who are thrown out of employment, or actually women's unemployment is now rising faster than the average, they will be hit hardest. Ethnic minorities who disproportionately depend on welfare services will be hit hardest. The already poorest families, single parent families, the poorest children will be hit hardest. So the cutting of welfare is over and above the general strategy of trying to shift the burden of the crisis onto working people. Is in addition to that, it's an attempt to shift the burden onto the very poorest sections among working people, and therefore is a particularly vicious and unjustified government policy.
I think children will be amongst the first to suffer from the economic crisis that we're in. And partly for a whole number of reasons, partly because of unemployment, which impacts badly on children, partly because of cuts to welfare, cuts to social service provision, which means that we are already seeing an alarming growth of child poverty. And this is something which in the 21st century, in a so-called advanced country, you would have thought would have been eradicated, but unfortunately this is not the case. And there are large areas of the more impoverished, the more badly affected areas by the recession and by the cuts, where life for many, many young people is becoming, and many, many kids, is becoming an absolute nightmare due to serious levels of poverty, which is just, it's just shocking in today's Britain. And so it's a kind of, you know, it's a man-made situation. And very often some of the experts and the media try to present it as something almost an inevitable product of natural causes. But I think it's far from that. I think it's a product particularly of the last 20 or 30 years of neoliberal economics, which has dominated the world stage and which has created huge profits for a tiny minority of people and therefore a massive inequality. And those at the bottom of society have, both in every country around the world, but also in the less developed countries, the countries that suffer from low levels of investment, that suffer from debt, that suffer from often actually military attack by the West, those countries have suffered disproportionately. So for me, child poverty and poverty in general in the 21st century is a crime.
There's about 2.8 million children, according to the most recent figures, that are suffering from what's termed child poverty across the UK. And we know that, in common with all kinds of poverty, this has a huge impact on people's lives. People who are suffering from financial need have all kinds of different problems, and it does directly impact on mental health, on physical health, and on their ability to get jobs and to interact with their friends and their family as well. And that is writ large with children who are suffering from poverty and from financial need as well.
Poverty in the 21st century in this country means, well, for children, it means their parents not being able to provide them with the real basic material necessities. And we're talking about parents not being able to afford to keep the house warm during the winter time, them not being able to afford enough nutritious food for their families. And we know that there is a big connection between children growing up in poverty and not doing very well at school, and therefore not going on to fulfil their lives, and having much greater chance of themselves being adults in poverty and their own children being in poverty. That's why it's essential that the government and society really takes a grip of the problem and tackles child poverty in Britain.
One of the things we found very surprising when we're looking at the report is the sheer scale in the reduction of incomes that we're forecasting to happen over the period from 2009 to 2012. The impact of the recession that's hit the UK economy hasn't really been translated across into reductions in household incomes as yet in the data that we've seen, but really that's just pain that's been delayed from the recession that we've just seen and the big reduction in the productive capacity of the UK economy. And that pain is due to hit households over the next few years.
In the last 10 years, although we've seen improvements in child poverty, one feature has been that the proportion of children in poverty who actually come from households with work has increased within the overall figure for children in poverty. I think that shows that while we made a lot of progress in the last decade for getting more households into work, that we weren't thinking enough about the quality of those jobs and the level of wages needed. It's really quite a dramatic figure to think about that if you go back a few decades, wages as a proportion of the whole economy was 65%. Today it's only 53%. So tackling the unfairness of wages for those at the bottom is a major thing. But we also have some quite entrenched problems that you still see very high levels of child poverty for lone parent families, for many minority ethnic groups, and also for families affected by disability.
The effect it's had is that she's got no way of actually driving the children around. They can't afford to have the car on the road all the time. They can't afford to. She can't actually get here or there, so she's got reliant on people. I've been doing shopping and helping with cleaning and cooking and helping the children. And it's been very, very difficult. She's fallen in the kitchen when her children were here and they've had to pick her up. And that was very difficult because they couldn't do it. They've had to ring their dad at work. I mean, this is disgraceful decision. And I think it's going to get worse. I think there are people being told, don't allow this. You know, as part of the government cuts, they're cutting the people who are doing these, so it takes from sort of 6 weeks to 6 months to get a decision anyway, and or 16 weeks, about 4 months to get a decision anyway on DLA stuff. And I think the average is about 13 weeks for a decision. This has probably been nearly that. And then you, well, nearly 2 months, and you end up with a situation where they're not allowing it anyway. I think in the next year, we are going to see massive child poverty. We will see children dying because they're cold or because their families are having to choose whether to heat their homes or to eat. And I think this government is a disgrace that they are going to see children dying in this country because they can't be fed and looked after. They can't even be clothed. I mean, just to get a reasonable pair of shoes, you're paying £15-20. You know, even if you go to the market, stuff is really expensive, just basic things. The government wants us not to be obese, but if you're having to live on bread and jam sandwiches, like we did when we were younger, I was from a poor family, and I remember having bread and jam sandwiches and stuff, and that's what's happening now. Kids are having to live off of very cheap, fill-you-up foods, which are not ever so nutritious. We can't afford the sorts of stuff that David Cameron does. We struggle, and they wouldn't do it. I would say to David Cameron, you do it. And if you didn't pay so much out on war and all the stuff in Libya, you know, absolute disgrace that we are paying out billions of pounds of our money on wars in countries where we shouldn't have even gone. We shouldn't be interfering. It's an absolute disgrace.
If we didn't have this money being wasted on wars, we'd have more money for the social necessities of this country. And we'd bring about a far more peaceful world if we dealt with the issues of the HIV/AIDS epidemic or pandemic around the world. We dealt with issues of child poverty across the world. Far better to invest in the children of the world rather than bomb the adults of today.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The French President Emmanuel Macron criticized the European Commission for failing to defend the interests of its fishers operating in UK coastal waters, while his maritime minister said Paris would fight for their rights. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written jointly by Daniel Boffey and Stevens Morris, titled British Cabinet Minister Confident Article 16 Will Not Be Triggered. The article was published by The Guardian Daily. Please stay tuned. The prospects for a deal with the EU over post-Brexit arrangements for Northern Ireland have been raised, as Michael Gove claimed the government was confident it would not need to trigger Article 16, suspecting the current deal. The cabinet minister, who has special responsibilities for the union, suggested there were sufficient signs of progress after 5 weeks of talks that the government would not need to follow through on its recent threats. Gove said at a press conference following a summit meeting of the British-Irish Council, everyone recognizes that the application of the protocol at the moment is causing some disruption to trade and is causing inconvenience, at the very least, to citizens of Northern Ireland. He said, I do believe that there is a constructive approach that's being taken by the European Commission, and Lord Frost has signaled that while, of course, it's always possible that Article 16 may require to be invoked, we are confident that we will be able to make progress without it. It is understood Gove's optimism is not wholly shared by those more intimately involved with the negotiations, which are widely expected to run on past Christmas. But the combative language around previous meetings between David Frost, the UK Brexit Minister, and the European Commission Vice President Maroš Šefčovič have been dropped as the two chief negotiators talked in Brussels on Friday, November 19th. In a statement, Lord Frost said while significant gaps remained, there was the potential to generate some momentum in our discussions. He said, looking forward, the United Kingdom's preference remains to secure a solution based on consensus. European Commission, in a post-meeting statement, reiterated a call for a reciprocal move by Boris Johnson's government following the EU's proposal in October to cut out most checks on goods coming from Britain. The Commission added that it was essential that the recent change in tone now leads to joint tangible solutions in the framework of the protocol. But the EU did not double down on the claim made just a fortnight ago that the UK was failing to engage sincerely in the talks, nor did Šefčovič raise publicly the prospect of retaliatory moves should Article 16 be triggered. Both sides claimed that there had been progress in ensuring medicines authorized in Britain would be freely available in Northern Ireland, although there was some frustration on the EU side that agreement on that issue had not been yet found. The Commission said we now need to press on and get this crucial issue across the line. Frost had earlier told reporters that he had been heartened by comments on Thursday night, November 18, from the Irish Taoiseach Michael Martin. Martin said in an interview with reporters, where there is a will, there is a way, and I think both sides just need to knuckle down and get it resolved. Asked whether there was any prospect of a compromise solution on the UK's demand that the European Court of Justice lose its role as arbiter of disputes over EU law in Northern Ireland, Frost was conciliatory. He said, it's not an issue that we have managed to discuss very much so far. We have very different positions, but I know the Taoiseach said last night that the EU had serious intent to resolve the difficulties that we are facing. And I think that's a very good thing that we take that very seriously. Meanwhile, the French President Emmanuel Macron criticized the Commission for failing to defend the interests of its fishers operating in UK coastal waters, while his maritime minister said Paris would fight for their rights. Macron, who faces an election in April, told reporters during a visit to northern France that the UK should be forced to fulfill its treaty obligations. He said, "We did not get what we wanted. They are playing with our nerves." The French government claims it is due a further 150 licenses for vessels operating in the waters of the UK and Jersey, a British Crown dependency. The French Maritime Minister Annick Girardin told France Interradio, "We will continue to fight every day to get what should be ours, and so that those 150 licenses arrive." The Northern Ireland Protocol, in the withdrawal agreement that Johnson signed, keeps the region in the single market and draws a customs border down the Irish Sea in order to avoid a hard border on the island of Ireland. In October, the EU offered to drastically reduce the number of checks on goods coming from Great Britain to Northern Ireland in recognition of the political and economic disruption being caused. Recently, Shevchovich claimed these measures would create a type of express lane which would substantially facilitate trade between all parties. A win-win situation for all. It is a unique and completely new model for how goods can be moved from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, one that would strengthen opportunities for people and businesses alike. Frost and Shevchovich will meet again next Friday, November 26. Moreover, the war of words between the UK and France has continued, with London warning it could take legal action against Paris. Accusing the British of not respecting their agreements, Macron said, "We are going to continue to fight. We will not abandon our fishermen." Referring to British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the French leader said, "I said it very clearly to Boris." Under the Brexit trade deal concluded just before Christmas 2020, EU fishing boats can continue to fish in British waters if they obtain a license. But they need to prove that they previously were fishing there, a requirement that smaller French boats lacking the appropriate technology have found difficult to fulfill. Many have failed to secure licenses from authorities in the UK or the Channel Island of Jersey. France argues the boats are well known to the British authorities and their past records are common knowledge. Macron called on the European Commission to put pressure on Jersey Island, a British Crown dependency 22 kilometers off the French coast, to accept license applications from French fishermen to operate in its waters. The French president said, "The Commission must protect us. It has to see this through, but it's moving too slowly, too weakly," adding, "If the Commission doesn't play its part, France will do it." Macron promised that France will take a position on the issue before Christmas. The dispute escalated to the point where a British fishing boat was seized by the French officials, prompting the UK to summon Paris ambassador in London, a move that is usually made against enemies and not allies. Paris threatened London with sanctions if the issue would not be resolved by the end of November. The UK launched a counterattack, vowing legal action if Paris did not back down. Several rounds of talks between the two sides have been held this month, but have failed to resolve the dispute. Maritime Minister Annick Girardin said recently that France would continue to fight every day to get what should be ours, and so that those 150 licenses arrive. Paris is hoping to settle the fishing dispute in the few weeks that remain before its rotating presidency of the EU takes over in January, when it will have to take charge of all post-Brexit disputes.
simple question.
In Westminster, there's trouble over members of parliament with second jobs. The UK's opposition Labour Party has attacked the Conservatives, and Prime Minister Boris Johnson in particular, for allowing MPs to earn big money for extra work outside parliament. They say the Prime Minister was wrong to defend those who earn vast sums outside parliament for work that has nothing to do with their duty to represent the people who elected them and whose taxes pay their parliamentary salaries.
This dispute has arisen following revelations about former Conservative cabinet member Owen Paterson, who resigned from his parliamentary position after revelations concerning his external earnings and lobbying activities, which are forbidden under parliamentary rules. Since Mr. Paterson's departure, it has emerged that another Conservative MP, Sir Geoffrey Cox, earned almost £6 million by advising the British Virgin Islands over an investigation into governance issues.
I probably would never have had a practice.
Receiving money in order to lobby in Parliament is banned for all MPs. However, Boris Johnson has been highly resistant to changing the rules, and this has had consequences for his reputation. But the situation is made even more confusing by the discovery that all major parties have MPs who earn money outside their parliamentary duties. Indeed, both Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Leader of the Opposition, Sir Keir Starmer, have themselves made big money from second jobs, leading to an impact on their images too.
Does the public approve of party leaders like Sir Keir Starmer and Boris Johnson both earning large sums outside Parliament? And should MPs be allowed to have second jobs in the first place? Simple questions with important answers. And let's begin with what MPs earn for their work as members of Parliament. That's around £82,000 a year. How do people here in Westminster feel about that level of income? We asked them. Here's what they said.
I think they must earn something more. They must be rewarded. And overall, they must support us, all of us, especially now after the pandemic. We really need their support.
I don't think they're even worth that. I don't, honestly, I mean, they don't do nothing for the public. All they do is just sit there and make laws, and laws for themselves, and laws onto themselves. And they just criticise us for demonstrating and trying to get our rights.
I think that's okay for the job they do.
It's one role and it should be in one location. I appreciate they've got to be split into constituency office and serving in Parliament, but that should be it. And I think it's overpaid, because they did receive an extra £10,000 in relation to working from home for the pandemic. Is that going to come off their salary again? Is that included in the £82,000 or is that a plus? Yeah, yet to be clarified.
As long as they're representing their constituents, then that's okay.
And some MPs nowadays, you know, you haven't got the grassroots MPs that you used to have. You have career politicians, so they're in it for what they can get themselves rather than what I can do for my community and my constituency.
Seems reasonable.
MPs get about £82,000 a year. What do you think of that as a salary for a parliamentarian?
Well, I think it's a good salary compared to the general population, but I think if you want the top people, that might not be quite enough to attract them in. There's, you know.
It'll depend who you ask. For the sort of people that you're going to attract or want to attract in there, it's probably not a significant salary.
I think it's reasonable. Maybe, to be honest, it might even be a little bit low if they didn't have any other income.
That's a lot, but these are the people that rule the country, so hard to say. Maybe they deserve this money if they rule the country well enough.
Of course, the problem is not the salaries, the extras they get. I think if it's just the 82,000, that's fine. But I know they get more money for housing and for traveling. And then when you add up everything, they become expensive.
What do you think of an MP's income? That's currently set at around £82,000 a year, plus expenses. That's probably €100,000.
That's a lot. But isn't the sense behind it that you pay them a lot so they aren't corrupt? Are they corrupt? I don't know.
Well, they pay income tax on that. Well, I would say they should pay VAT on top of that as well.
Well, it will depend in the number of legislation that they do, right?
I think it's fair. Seems like a good wage to be earned in for that position. So I think it's fair.
Some MPs earn hundreds of thousands of pounds in second jobs outside Parliament. How do ordinary people feel about that?
If they pay taxes, I don't mind. If we pay taxes, you can do as much as you can. I don't mind.
Some of them earn hundreds of thousands of pounds a year in second jobs. What do you think?
Absolutely horrific. We need experienced MPs that do have life experience. Life experience is vital in order to act on behalf of your constituencies.
I think that's disgraceful. You know, I believe that if you are an MP, you're there to serve your constituents and your community, not to go and feather your nest by doing 2, 3, 4 jobs.
I think 900,000, it sounds like, I'm not sure what they're paying for. That might be a bit much. And, you know, for 900,000, they're expecting a lot. And then especially, you know, if there's a conflict, it's no good.
Some of them take it into their own hands and earn hundreds of thousands a year doing other work and second jobs. What do you make of that?
I didn't realise they did until just this last week or so, and I was quite surprised. And I can understand why some of them need to, but I think it's almost at times abusing the privilege of their position.
I think it's okay. I think as long as it doesn't get in the way and they're not using government resources to earn those funds, I don't see anything wrong with another job on the side.
Second jobs are often, in politics, not really what you want. And especially if it's about that large sum of money, shouldn't be the case, I think.
I think it's quite offensive, to be honest, if they're using the time that they should be giving to their constituents for earning other money.
That's not moral, in my opinion. They should focus entirely on governing, on being the politicians, not the businessmen. No, I don't think so.
We've learned this week that MPs earn hundreds of thousands of pounds in second jobs outside Parliament, often lobbying and so on. What do you make of that?
Well, I think people voted for them to the MPs to represent them in Parliament, not to be doing something else, to have the focus on the country. There are loads of issues and important issues here.
Well, maybe somebody's paying them, so they maybe do something in the parliament for them.
I think it's a bit of a betrayal, really.
It's a bit steep, considering at the minute with the NHS as well, like, struggling. Surely more money could be funded into the NHS rather than MPs' salaries, but that's just my opinion.
I don't think that should happen. I think the first job should be as an MP.
Second jobs meaning lobbying? Yeah, I think that's terrible. It happens in the States all the time, and I think it leads to just an oligarchy, basically, of business.
Boris Johnson, who, as an MP, has himself earned over £1 million from second jobs since 2015, has been slow to commit to reforming the system. What does the public think of this?
I wish him all the best, but Boris, please be honest with us. Please, as much as you can. Yeah, you must be honest. Now, even more than before, yeah.
He's totally shirked his responsibility. And I think the ethos that he should be leading from the front, when he isn't, he's losing support of his own colleagues.
Again, disgraceful behaviour. As the leader of our country, I would expect him to set the example in everything he does.
He's definitely part of the system, so I'm not surprised by that.
No wonder he's pretty tardy in trying to change the rules. I mean, let's be honest, everybody's human, and they sometimes find it difficult to separate their personal interests from maybe the public interest. So not not overly thrilled, but then if you look at the Prime Minister, the 24/7 nature of the role, then his salary is, to be honest, laughable.
What do you think about the fact that Boris Johnson, all this is going on, Boris Johnson earned £1.5 million outside Parliament from other jobs?
We know that. We know it's all going on anyway. They all try and keep it a secret, but there's always a leak.
I understand that he's slow, because it's in his benefit, but yeah, that also shouldn't be the case.
Fortunately, I will say nothing, because I am not from UK, but if the same situation will happen in Poland, I will be very nervous.
It's not illegal, I think it's immoral, because he's doing something else instead of leading the country and making loads of money. When being the Prime Minister, he should be just focused on doing the job, leading the country, especially with Brexit and the pandemic and loads of important issues here.
Well, I think there is a self-interest there, right? There are certain bias. I'm perfectly fine if politicians, before stepping in the office, they have certain interests, but then when they step in office, they need to put that separate and make sure that they are doing a proper job for the people.
Of course, it should be reformed, and I'm not going to go any further about Boris Johnson.
So we can blame all this on Boris Johnson. However, we had a Labour government for how many years? 10 years? What did they do to reform it? Were they not taking advantage as well?
The figures tell a revealing financial story. As we have noted, Conservative Prime Minister Boris Johnson has earned £1.6 million since re-entering Parliament in 2015. But one of his main critics, Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer, himself earned £26,000 for 106 hours of legal work, receiving £18,000 for one day's worth of work. Perhaps even more surprisingly, Labour politician Chris Bryant MP, who chairs the Committee on Standards and Privileges, earned £2,000 from Goldman Sachs for giving a speech. In total, over 200 MPs have received declarable earnings above their MP salary in the last year.
Is the public aware that Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer, who has attacked the Conservatives for second jobs, has earned tens of thousands of pounds from second jobs himself? And what do they think of that?
Mate, they're all at it. Listen, there's no such thing as Labour, Liberal, Conservative. There's no such thing as that no more. They're all one agenda. And the one agenda is they all rule by the same means and the same tactics.
Well, I just think, if it's okay for him to do that, and that might be his opinion and he could make the case, then he shouldn't criticize other people. In general, you know, I think, you know, the leader of a major political party should be busy enough doing that.
It's exactly the same, so it's quite cynical having a crack at one of the other parliamentarians, and then you're doing the same yourself, so.
He's not doing what, you know, the constituents want him to do, and he's not listening, and then that becomes an issue, obviously. I think that's his job, to listen to the people, and if they're calling for reform, he needs to obviously take it into consideration. And if he's not doing that, then I think a deeper look needs to occur.
No, I didn't know that, but again, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, why? I mean, if you think about it, if they're allowed to do it, and they always trump out this thing, I didn't do anything wrong, the law allows me to do it. Well, who sets the law? Well, I set the law. Well, of course it isn't. I mean, come on, really. I mean, if we were able to do that, even, you know, ordinary people able to do that, we wouldn't break the law.
This is a problem not with the Labour or the Conservatives, a problem with the Parliament, with the rules. They are doing that because they can do that. They are allowed to do that, so they need to change the rules.
If he's a part of it as well, he equally should be disciplined in accordance with a code that is sufficient to deal with all MPs. You don't change it just for you. Disciplinary code across the board that affects everybody.
So Sir Keir Starmer, the head of the Labour Party, the head of the opposition, himself has earned £18,000 in one day. He's a barrister, a lawyer, outside of Parliament. What do you make of that across Parliament?
They just all seem to be very high paid, like it's all high paid salaries, no one's like minimum wage, like there's so many people on minimum wage at the minute, and they, like, I'm not saying that they don't do a lot for the country, but some of them sure.